Starting this week in Parshas Tzav, we have a number of different korbanos that we're going to read about. So it starts with a korban ola. Zos Torah sa ola. This is the law of the ola, and then it kind of slips in. It doesn't really give us the laws of the ola. It gives us the laws of Trumas Hadeshen, right, which is removing the ashes that happens before you bring the first korban of the day. So we have the ola, and we have the Chatas and the Asham and the Toda. We have a number of different korbanos that are spoken about in this week's Parsha. And during the discussion about Korban Mincha, the Pasuk tells us the following. So this is in Source 1, describing the Korban Mincha. It says, Lo se'afe chametz, do not bake it into chametz. Chalkam nasatiosa me'ishai. Their portion is, right, I'm giving their portion from my korban. So this is the korban mincha, and the korban mincha is partially burned on the mizbeach. A handful is burned on the mizbeach, and then the shiarei hamincha, what's left over from the mincha, goes to the kohanim. And the kohanim are allowed to eat that flour. They're allowed to make it into something, but lo siyafe chametz, but you're not allowed to bake it into chametz. So this is, we have heard earlier in Sefer Vayikra, we already heard last week that you're not allowed to bring chametz on the Mizbeach. That was already discussion. You're not allowed to bring dvash, honey, or chametz on the Mizbeach. And this is adding something a little different, which is even what's left over from the Korban Mincha, that itself cannot be baked into chametz. Right, there are, so let's just pause for say that for a second. Okay, Kodesh Kadashim Hi. It is Kodesh Kadashim. It is the Holy of Holies. Kachatas v'cha'asham. It is Kodesh Kadashim. It is Holy of Holies. Just like, right, what's the reference point? It's like Chatas and the Asham. Right, so the sin offering and an Asham also is something that you bring in with, it's like a guilt offering, we might say, something like that. So, that's the pasuk we're gonna be based off of for right now. Now you might have thought Pesach's coming up, so chametz, that's the way to go, right? So we're gonna discuss chametz. So that's actually not what I'm gonna focus on. It happens to be that you can note this additional law of chametz, right? So we had you're not allowed to make chametz on mizbeach. The mincha is not allowed to become chametz, even what's left over. And then you have like a couple of what seem to be exceptions. You have the Korban Toda, where some of the bread is chametz, and you have the Shtei Alechem of Shavuos, right? There are two loaves of bread that you bring on the holiday of Shavuos, which are also chametz. So those seem to be the exceptions. So trying to figure out, just keeping in mind, as we're approaching Pesach, we might try to figure out, if we're paying attention to the Parsha, why might some of the, there's a general rule against chametz, why is that? And then why do you have certain exceptions? So although that would be appropriate to talk about, I want to point out something different in this pasuk, which comes from the Kli Yakar. So the Kli Yakar notes, as I commented on the pasuk, right? I commented on it because of the Kli Yakar. So when the mincha is described, so it says Kodesh Kadashim Hi. This mincha is Kodesh Kadashim, just like, right? So then the pasuk fills in, you know, almost like the paradigm of Kodesh Kadashim, right? The Torah wants us to know the mincha is Kodesh Kadashim just like the other thing which is Kodesh Kadashim, the Chatas and the Asham. So the Kli Yakar says, Ki ha-chatas v'ha-asham ha-ba'im al kaparas ha-chet, a Chatas and an Asham, which are brought in order to atone for a sin. So Chatas and Asham are brought for kapara, they're brought for atonement. Nikru'u Kodesh Kadashim. Those korbanos are called Kodesh Kadashim, the Holy of Holies. Ki hatzadik gamor shelo chata klal, because a tzadik gamor, a completely righteous person, shelo chata klal, who has not sinned at all, Kodesh hu laHashem, that's a holy person. Right? A tzadik who has not sinned, he is Kodesh, he is holy. Aval hachote vishav v'tshuva, who Kodesh Kadashim. But somebody who sinned, somebody who did something wrong, And then they did tshuva. Then they came back. Then they returned. They got atonement for that. That person is Kodesh Kadashim.
Sounds like Chabad.
Okay. Keep a makom. Shabale tshuva omdim. Ein tzadikin gemurim yecholim la'amod ba. Right? So it's rooted in Chazal. Right? This idea. Keep a makom shabale tshuva omdim. In the place that bale tshuva stand. Ein tzadikin gemurim. Even completely righteous people cannot yecholim la'amod ba. Are not able to stand there. So we have this idea from Chazal that there's something unique about the position of Baalei Tshuva, people who have veered off of the path, right? Whatever they've done in some way, whatever that might mean, right? In particular situations or sins, whatever that might be, but people who have sinned, who have done the wrong thing and then found the right way, those are Kodesh Kadashim. They reach a certain place that even Tzadikim Gemurim, even completely righteous people cannot reach that same place.
Just note that, I mean, setting aside Hashamas, which is what, six types of intentional actions, I mean, it's really interesting that, I mean, Chattis is only brought if you made a mistake. You really were not intending to, but even so, you have to do tshuva. Even in that case.
Great. So this point about Chatas being on the list, that's going to be noted in the next verse. So we'll point that out as well. But thank you for noticing that. So the Kliyakar's suggestion, his claim is that why is it compared to Chatas and Asham, right? If we're looking for the model of Kodesh Kadashim, we want to describe something as the Holy of Holies. Why do we look at the Chatas, the sin offering, and the Asham, the guilt offering? Because a Baal Tshuva, somebody who is bringing Chatas, it means they did something wrong, and now they're trying to fix their problem by bringing Chatas. They're going to say Vidui. They're going to admit their mistake. So then that person is Kodesh Kadashim. And then even the last line, this line about Makom Shabali Tshuva Omdim, there's slightly different ways of understanding that line, but the Kliyakar clearly says at the end of source 2, Vizem Madriga Gidola She'ino B'tzadik Gamor Milvad Shar Milos Shezach Rav Seinuzal. Right, so this idea of that the Gemara Bracho said, oh, we didn't see the Gemara Yoma, but again, this idea that Chazal are referring to, that they keep referring to the heights that a Baal Tshuva can reach, this is a Madriga Gedola, this is a greater level than even a Tzadik Gamor can reach. Al-Kain Din Hu Shiyah HaChatas Kodesh Kadashim. And that's why the Chatas is Kodesh Kadashim. Okay? So that's the idea of the Kliyakar, that the Chatas is the model of Kodesh Kadashim. Now, Rav Moshe Sternbach, in his Sefer Tam V'Das, so this is in Source 3, and he starts by quoting the Kliyakar. He says, go check out the Kliyakar, see what he says. But he points out an interesting observation about the Kliyakar. He says, "Udvarav chidush gadolhim." So as, you know, we might see the Kliyakar, and it's a nice idea. It's a nice idea to say that Baalei Tshuva, people who've you know, gone the wrong way and then found the right way again, so they're even greater. They have a mila. They have a virtue or an advantage that other people don't have. Dvarav chidush gadolhim. But that, to say that they're Kodesh Kadashim, but Tzadikim are Kodesh, he says that's a big chiddush. It's a big claim. That's an interesting idea. The Kliyakar is saying, "Dinira shemaylas habaal tshuva al hatzadik meikaro," right? Because what if I asked, right? If I saw that statement from the Gemara that Baalei Tshuva are better, why? What's the reason that a Baal Tshuva is better? Why would I think? Right, again, we're using better, whatever, but it's not so clear that Mila means better per se. I'm not sure that's like it's a little bit of a different kind of word. But what is the advantage of a Baal Tshuva? Hu rak kishehaya chote v'nisgaber al yitzro bechozek v'amad b'nisyonos. Right, what is the case of a Baal Tshuva? I would think that a Baal Tshuva is somebody who chose to do the wrong thing, and then nisgaber al yitzro, and then he overpowered his, you know, his inclination, his desires, v'amad b'nisyonos, and then he started to literally, he's like to pass the test, right, to pass the tests. That that the idea of a Baal Tshuva is somebody who, you know, they were choosing, making the wrong choice, and then they realized, I'm making the wrong choice. I should start changing my life, so I'm going to decide and actively choose to do the right thing. So that, I would think, that is what the Baal Tshuva, the Baal Tshuva that we're describing should be that kind of person, right? That why is a Baal Tshuva better? Because he is like overcoming his natural desires in order to do the right thing. But does that match the korban that we're talking about? Aval mi shechata b'shogeg, somebody who made a mistake, v'nodalo, v'achshav mevi korban. So what's the case of a chatas? It's where you accidentally made a mistake, then you were informed that you made that mistake, and then you bring a korban. Ein nira shetia teshuvaso chashuva kol kach lahadifo al kedushaso shel tzadik gamor. So it's a big chiddush, as he said. It's not so obvious that the Kli Yakar is correct, right? You might not have thought that. It's not so obvious that somebody who makes a mistake and then is told about the mistake and brings a korban, that his tshuva makes him better than a tzaddik gamor. A tzaddik gamor never made a mistake and never chose to do the wrong thing. This guy made a mistake and then he brought a korban, so now he's better. He's a kodesh kadashim. And the tzaddik is kodesh. So the Rav Shnurbach says, it's not, you know, that's an interesting idea from the Kli Yakar, but the way it applies to the Chatas doesn't really seem to fit. Doesn't really seem to make sense here. And Rav Shnurbach goes on to kind of re-explain what he thinks the way you should understand this. So Rav Shnurbach kind of gives a different explanation. But this problem of the Tam V'Das, I think, is going to be our first, you know, our first overall question. Is there a way to kind of defend the Kli Yakar the way he says it, right? Is there a way to understand what the Kli Yakar means, right? Why should it be that somebody who makes a mistake, b'shogeg, and then goes to fix their sin, why should that person be better than a tzaddik gamor? Why should that person be better than just a regular righteous person, all right? By somebody who chose the wrong path, and then they overcame that. So I understand why he's better than a tzaddik. But just someone who brings a chatas, he just made a mistake and then he figured it out. So he came to the Beis Hamikdash. Why should that person also be better than a tzaddik gamor? Why should that be? Okay, so that's question one. Question two takes us to the Haggadah. Now we get to Pesach. Okay, so so I want to look at famous part of Magid, I guess the whole, I don't know if there's any not famous part of the Haggadah. The only not famous part of the Haggadah is the part where we actually tell the story, because people don't really know the psukim. But besides that, right, we have the other parts of the Haggadah. So we're told about the four sons. Okay, so we're told in the Mishnah that you should teach children based on their understanding. You should try to reach each person based on, you know, where they are right now. And then in the Haggadah, I think we reflect that by saying there are multiple kinds of people at the Seder. So we say it as the four sons. So I want to look at the question, two of the questions, the first two. So the first one is Chacham. Chacham mahu omer. What does the Chacham say? Maha idus v'hachukim v'amishpatim. What are all of these laws? Asher tziva Hashem Elokeinu, that God has commanded eschem you. So what are all of these laws that God has commanded you? Okay, that's the question of the Chacham. Rasha mahu omer. The Rasha, what does he say? Maha avoda hazos lachem. Maha avoda, what are these rules? Hazos, this, lachem, to you. What are these laws that you got, that you do? So the question of the Chacham, we listen to him and we say, oh, good question, great. And then we answer him, we explain everything. And we spend time, right? We give him all the Hilchos HaPesach, all the way to the end. So that's the Chacham. And because he said, what are all of these laws that God commanded you? Now the Rasha stands up and says, what are these things that you're doing? Like, oh, a Rasha. Right, Hakei Eshinav, right? So whatever that means, that we knock out his teeth, right? We're not literally describing it. It's not – but whatever we're describing there, our response to the Russia is, oh, my gosh, I can't believe he asked that question. That's crazy. Now, if we put the two questions next to each other, right, without if we're not using our Haggadah that has, like, pictures where you know, we can see that, like, the Chacham is the guy who comes with, you know, a suit and tie, I don't know, and the Russia is – depending on when your Haggadah was made, whatever we thought a like crazy looking person looked like, right? The wrong kind of person, whatever that would be, right? So so if you don't have your pictures, right? What makes us look at the Russia's question next to the Chacham? They both say, "What is this? What are the laws? The Avoda or the Eidos Chukim and Mishpatim?" Right? And it says the Chacham says that God commanded Eschem, that God commanded you, and the Russia says Lachem, you. So if you put the questions next to each other, they don't really sound so different. I'll acknowledge that the Haggadah says, oh, the Russia says, Lachem, he excludes himself. He says you, but not himself, right? But that's clearly, I would think, if you really look at the questions, it's not, the Haggadah's not really, doesn't seem to be giving a full explanation of why we think it's a bad question, because again, the Chacham himself also says Eschem, which also sounds like you, right? Eschem literally means you. So, so the Chacham asks, what are all these laws that God commanded you? The Russia says, what are you guys doing? And all of a sudden, we get really mad at the Russia, right? So what is it? What is it about the question of the Russia? What is it about the question of the Russia that makes us think that his question is actually not a good question, right? Maybe it's just somebody who's wondering, what are you guys doing? Maybe he's very curious. What makes us think that the Russia is actually a Russia, right? So just broad approaches, if we think about it, right, how do we approach this question? So what we might have to do, potentially, is go word phrase by phrase or word by word and say, they look the same, but are they really the same, right? It sounds like the same question as the Chacham, but is it really the same question? Is Avoda... Maybe avoda is the word. It was a bad word choice by the Russia. Maybe it's hazos. Maybe he's like the way he's focusing on him. Maybe it's lachem. So you have to go like one right. We might have to go like word by word and see. Maybe this is the word that makes us think that the Russia is in fact a Russia and not just a chacham. He's just another kid who's asking a question. But that is going to be question two. Question two is, what is it? What is it that makes us label the Russia a Russia? What makes us think that he's not just asking a question, just like the Chacham is? Now we're going to go to that Mishnah in Psachim that I mentioned. I mentioned that the four sons seem to be a reflection of the Mishnah in Arve Psachim, which is the last perek in Maseches Psachim. So, I wrote Aleph Dalet. That should be Yud Dalet. In source 5, it's not the first parak, it's actually the 10th parak. But in that Mishnah, it says that you should, after Manishtana, which the Mishnah recounts for us, right, the questions of Manishtana, then says, and then you teach in line with each child, right, whatever each child can understand, that's how you teach them. So that seems to be the four sons. And then we're told, Maschil Biginus Umesayim B'Shevach. That when you tell the story, you should start with the gnus, you should start with the bad, the disgrace, umisayim b'shevach. And you should end, you should conclude with shevach. So you start with the bad and you end with the good. And then the Mishnah tells us exactly which psukim we should use. So those are the psukim of Arami Oved Avi, the ones that we're told in the Haggadah, that we include in the Haggadah, that we say Arami Oved Avi, that we talk about Lavan a little bit, that Yaakov ended up going down to Mitzrayim, and then we tell the story using those four psukim. So this idea of Maschil Beginusu Misayim B'Shevach. So why do we tell the story that way? Why is it Maschil Beginusu Misayim B'Shevach? Why do we tell the story in that process in that order? The Pachad Yitzchak, so Rav Yitzchak Kuttner, we quoted before. This piece, actually, we quoted kind of the end of this mimer last year, I think around like Lech Lecha. So we quoted actually like the end of it, and this is pieces from earlier in the same one. It has a little bit of a different focus earlier in the piece, and that's what we're going to use today. So he, as he often does, he quotes the Maharal. So that's the beginning of source 6. He says, "Uba al zeh habeir shel haMaharal bezeh halashon." So this idea of maschil beginus u'masayim b'shavach is explained by the Maharal. V'chaasher tavin od. And when you think about it a little bit more, right? When the translation of the Pachad Yitzchak is mine, so there's a problem. You can blame me on that one. But v'chaasher tavin od. When you delve into it a little bit more, teda, then you'll understand. You'll know hashavach shekodem lo gnus. Who yoser shavach? Now, when you have shavach, when you have praise that was preceded by gnus, by disgrace or bad, so then it is even more shavach. If you have good that was preceded by bad, then the good is even better. If you just have good on its own, if you just have a happy situation, so then it's somewhat good. It's somewhat, you can be somewhat happy. But if you are coming from something which is bad, something which is actively gnus in this case, right? It's a bad situation. And then, right, then you are led to shevach, you're led to glory. Then the glory is even greater in contrast to what preceded it, right? So setting up those two sides, that when you have shevach, you can praise Hashem. Right, we can talk about the good that God did for us. But if we start by saying the Jewish people originally we were slaves, right? So there's a little bit of discussion. What's the gnus? What's the disgrace that we're supposed to describe? So whether it's slavery or our idol worship, but either way, if we take this idea that to say that God gave us a lot of things is a different story than saying, first, we were slaves. We had nothing, right? We were davening out. We were davening to Hashem. We knew that. We could think of all of these things, all of this whole life that we wanted for ourselves, and we didn't have it. And then God came and He gave us all of it. And He took us out, and He, right. So that whole process, that's a very different story than just saying, "Oh, God came. God came, and He brought us to Har Sinai." But we actually, if we go through all the steps and we realize where we were coming from, when we say we were slaves, or we say that Avram came from a family of idol worshippers, came from complete disconnection and no relationship with God, and we were able to create a family that made a covenant with God, that has a connection. So that story is very different. Kimo shetira shehayom kodem halayla. Just like we see, it's the phrasing here is kind of funny. I wonder if I mistyped it. But the point is, right, that this is one of the times if we think about halachic day, right? When we talk about, right, when does Shabbos start? Shabbos starts at night, right? So we kind of like intellectually know that, right? We think about the fact that right, that the Jewish calendar starts at night, right? But I don't think all of us in our heads, I can't speak for anybody else, right, that I, myself, right, it's don't really make the full shift that it means, right? It's not just that the calendar starts at night. It means the whole day is backwards. We think of waking up in the morning, and then at the end of the day, we go to sleep at night. But really, in the Jewish world, it's literally the opposite. It's actually the opposite. It's not just that like the calendar changes at night, but the day, right? The day starts with nighttime and it ends with daytime, right? It ends with the end of the day. Every single day, you actually, the start of the day is nighttime, right? So, and then we like sleep in the middle. It also comes out kind of funny, right? We sleep in the middle of the day, not at the end, which is again, like, I think like a big, like, paradigm shift in like what the day actually is that we don't usually make. We just think that like, okay, like the calendar, the date changes at night, right? But Rav Hunter is pointing out, right, that in our calendar, the night really starts really happens before the day, right? It's not just that the calendar changes at sunset, but that if we say that sunset is not just the end, but we look at, okay, now we're starting the day. So night precedes day, right? Night always precedes day. And when you look at that, then the daytime is very different, right? The daytime is coming out of night. It is or that result that comes after choshech. So that type of right, that sunrise, now daytime is very different because sunrise is not just the beginning of the day, but it's coming out of the nothingness of night. It is coming out of the darkness and the black of night. Right, and Olam Hazeh, the world that we live in, so we can't really have or at the beginning, but our world goes from nothingness to from choshech, right? That nothingness of choshech, of dark, of night, to yom, to or, to being complete, right? We don't start in a state of completeness. We don't start from a place of being complete. But the Maharal says that this idea of the contrast, right? The idea that the highs are even higher, right? When we recognize how low we were before. So he's extending that a little bit and saying that in the natural world, the world that we live in, that is always the process. It is always one from Laila to Yom. It is one from nothing to something. From Chisaron, he's going to say, from lacking, from Chisaron, from missing, to Shlemos. In order to reach Shlemos, in order to reach being complete, we have to have started as incomplete, right? You can only reach being complete if you were first incomplete. So first you were missing something, and then you became something. You were missing, and now you have. You always have to go through that process. Okay, so that's the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. The true story of Yetzias Mitzrayim is Maschil Beginus Umisayim B'Shevach. Not just in contrasting the two, but just like Laila and then Yom, just like there's night and then day, Choshech and then Or, and the Or of our world always has to be preceded by Choshech, right? I think he even alludes to what seems to be a more Kabbalistic idea, but even if you go to the beginning of Sefer Bereishis, even before the creation of Or, there is Choshech, right? The Torah actually spells out that there is Choshech, right? Because again, even at the beginning of creation, in order for there to have been a created Or, for our world, Or had to have been preceded by Choshech. You always have to go through this process of from Chisaron, of not having, to being complete. That's the story of Pesach, to go from Genus, from nothing, to Shlemus, to being complete, to being full and whole. And Rav Huttner says, this is the part that kind of hit me. Ofen hasipur shel yetzias Mitzrayim ba behat'ama letochen hasipur. So now, if that's the story, if the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, the tochen hasipur, the content of the story is from genus to shevach, from Laila to Yom, if that's the content of the story, Rav Huttner says, the way we tell the story perfectly matches the content of the story. So now it's not just the events of the story. We're recounting the events. But the way we do it, the ofen hasipur, matches perfectly. In what way? Ki kishem shetochen hasipur, just like the events of the story, mechayiv lesaper es inyan hageula, that we tell the redemption davka betur shlemus shetzamcha mitoch chisaron, right? So there's a completeness that came from chisaron, from lacking, from missing. Just like that's the content, the actual events of the story, kimochein ofen hasipur, so too the way we tell the story, but davka betoras teshuva al she'ila. So too, we tell the story, the way we tell the story is always from question to answer. And that follows the same process of a place of chisaron to a place of shlemus. There's a question which is coming from a place of chisaron. I don't have. I'm missing information. I'm lacking understanding. And then you now learn something, so you have now reached a sense of filling in that hole. You were missing something, and now you are complete, because now you are getting an answer to your question. So the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim is the story of the Jewish people going from Chisaron to Shlemus, and the way we tell the story is by individually going from questions, from Chisaron, to answers, to a sense of Shlemus. Right? And that is this the what he finishes this paragraph at the top of page 2, where he finishes continues this idea. Hello, davar mechuvar hu, because it's very clear. Ki kol hasaga, every understanding shiniskabla letochenu bitur hatara shel sveikosenu. Any idea which is received, which is taken in order to solve a problem, obitur pitaron lekushiyotenu, or as a solution to a question, anything which solves a problem or answers a question, shivcha gedola, we appreciate that more, we take it in more, we better incorporate that into our lives and our world, yoser ma'asher im haisa hasaga zonik latas pesochenu, more than if we heard it bederech stam, just like on its own. If we just hear an idea on its own, so then we can say, "Oh, nice idea." But it often just rolls off. It's a lot harder to make it fit into the way we see the world, unless it's actually solving a question that we had. When we have a problem and then we find a solution, oh wow! Did you hear that? That's amazing. But if I just hear an idea, nice idea. Okay, that's cool. But it doesn't have the same feeling. It doesn't bring with it the same experience, and we don't take it in the same way, unless it's coming from a place where we felt like we were missing something. You're giving me information, but I didn't feel like I was missing anything. I didn't feel like I was missing information. So now you can say it to me, but I don't really I don't take it in the same way, because I didn't have a sense that I needed it. I didn't have a sense that I was missing anything anyway. So you, in order for this new idea, it has to like break its way in, because I'm already shalem. I'm already complete. I'm good. So if I'm already fine, you can tell me all sorts of beautiful, nice ideas and inspirational speeches. But at the end of the day, if I felt like I was fine, then you're not solving anything. You're not helping me. So it's okay. So it's a nice idea. But that will be it. So that process, that idea of question and answer, is this same idea of going from chisaron to shlemus. But if you are already shalem, if you're already complete, then things don't get in there, right? And that's why, in order to truly learn, you have to go through this process of gnus to shevach. Not just in the actual events of Yetzias Mitzrayim, but the way we tell the story is to go from gnus to shevach, from the same process. The ofen hasipur, the way we tell the story, also has to be a process where I feel personally like I don't have, and then at the end I'm getting it from, I'm learning something. I now have something I did not have before. Adam Grant, in his book Originals, so we've quoted him before. There are a number of people that are in the rotation. So sometimes it's original research, but there are other people who put things together. So Adam Grant, he is an organizational psychologist at Wharton, just as the one-liner. So he is an author of Give and Take, which is really great. It's a really good book. I encourage everyone to read. I don't know. I guess I shouldn't encourage. I don't remember exactly all the details. So before I can encourage anything, I guess I'd reread it. But anyway, he's author of Give and Take, Originals, and Think Again. I think we may have quoted from each of them at some point. So in his book Originals, which is about creativity, coming up with ideas and getting them kind of accepted. So he has a chapter that talks about, I think this is in his chapter on groupthink, which is the first line there, right? Which has to do with when we are coming up with ideas as a group, when we are evaluating ideas as a group, there are certain pitfalls that we often fall into. So one of them is, so it's referred to as a category is groupthink. But groupthink, right, leads to different kinds of issues where, you know, we think we're all in agreement when we're not really, right? That's like one of the issues that can come up because some people just don't really speak up, right? So that's an issue. And there are other problems that happen when you are evaluating an idea as a group. So Adam Grant points to the idea that there are many people who think, or there are many leaders who will say, right, don't come with problems, come with
answers.
Yeah, exactly, right? So don't come with questions, come with answers. Don't come with problems, come with solutions. Something like that, right? Some idea that if you're going to point out something wrong, then you I don't want to hear that. I want to hear how you're going to fix it, right? Something like that. So he points out that there, right? It makes sense, right? There's a reason to do that. There's a sense of you know, responsibility that comes with it. There's a sense of not just trying to poke holes in everything, but trying to actually improve things, right? So there's a reason to that people say that. But he points out, but when it comes to groupthink, there's a dark side to encouraging solutions. Okay, so there's a problem that sometimes arises when you have such a focus that you can't say anything unless you also have a solution. So he suggests the following. He points to researcher Hoffman is one of the world's preeminent authorities on creating organizational cultures that detect, correct, and prevent errors. Okay, so that is his specialty. After the space shuttle Columbia exploded upon reentry into the atmosphere in 2003, so you may remember that there are a couple of famous shuttle disasters. So the Columbia burned up on the way back, right? As opposed to the explosion that happened on the way to space. So the Columbia burned up in the atmosphere on its way back to Earth. So it had gone through the whole mission, and then in returning to Earth, they kind of lost contact with it and then realized what had happened. So Hoffman's research was instrumental in assessing and documenting improvements in NASA's safety culture. So the culture survey that he helped create was completed by every NASA employee and since has reached over 200,000 employees across more than 1,000 companies. So he led the research in NASA and applying it outside of NASA across other industries, right? So it's establishing its usefulness in other, you know, other companies, other industries all over the world. Okay, so Hoffman found that a culture that focuses too heavily on solutions becomes a culture of advocacy, dampening inquiry. So if you're told when you come to this meeting, you better have a solution, then what are you going to do? You are going to be an advocate for your solution. And what tends to get lowered is your actual sense of trying to better understand the problem and everybody else's own ideas that are at the table. If you're always expected to have an answer ready so that when you come, you found a problem, but you better have an answer. So when you come, you've already in your head solved the problem, right? You're already coming with what you think is the right answer. So you'll arrive at meetings with your diagnosis complete, missing out on the chance to learn from the perspectives that are at the table, right? The whole advantage of doing this in a group is because we have different perspectives. But if you now come and you've already figured out your answer, then you're much less likely to actually listen to the other people at the table, right? That's the element of groupthink, which is that a group is a heterogeneous group, right? We're not the same. We're specifically coming with different ideas and different thoughts, and we don't have the same experiences. But you're all gonna, that's the point of why we're doing this together. But now, what are you going to do? You're always just going to argue for your point because this is what you came with. This is the one you were supposed to have. Okay. So a day after the Columbia shuttle took off, a mystery object was seen floating away in orbit. And if an inquiry had been launched, so then they might have discovered that it was actually a hole in the left wing, right? Maybe they could have fixed it before they had come back. So that was his assessment of the Columbia situation, that NASA had a culture where if you were going to speak up, you had to have a solution. And if you always have to have a solution, if you always have to have solved a problem, then you can't just pose a problem. You can't – what are your perspectives on this? Because if you bring that up, well, how are you going to solve it? How are you going to fix it? Okay, so now – so I have to come with a solution. But whenever I come with a solution, that means I've already solved the problem. So now there's no space for better understanding and for really investigating it. This is something that he goes into more in his book Think Again, which has to do with again that there are different ways that we approach our ideas. One of them is, you know, being an advocate is that I'm just trying to convince you that I'm right. Because if that's the culture, that the one that says that you always have to have a solution, so you're much more likely to end up saying, I have my idea, and that and that's what I'm going to push forward on. So this,
that's why the Roche of the Sanhedrin goes last, because otherwise people just sort of mimic.
Right. Right. So this comes out in different ways, right? That there are a number of different strategies for encouraging
inquiry,
right? And curiosity, and for dampening problems of groupthink. And one of them is, right, being very careful about who expresses an opinion and when. That also gets to, right, related to that is also like, that's why when we talk about brainstorming meetings, right, the research generally shows that better than a brainstorming meeting where everyone sits around the table and then you say, like, okay, everyone give ideas, is first everybody write your own ideas. It's funny because it's like a flip side of this, which is you need to give everyone space to also think. If your purpose is brainstorming, which might be a little different than what we're talking about, but if your purpose is brainstorming, then sometimes you need to give people space to think on their own and then come up with ideas. Because once certain people talk, then those are the ideas everyone's going to gravitate towards. You ever heard the, you have to, sometimes people warn about watching out for the hippo. The hippo is the highest paid person. So they talk about that. So again, so when it comes to the Sanhedrin, so you have a rule that, right, the gadol, the greatest person in the group, speaks last. Because you want everyone to be able to actually voice their opinion. Which again is almost like a flip side to this, which is like, right, which is like, not the flip side, but you're balancing a lot of different issues, which is the fact that, like, you want everyone to say their piece, but you don't want the people to be so stuck to their solution that they're not able to listen to others. And that's part of the balancing act that you're running when you're working with a group. But in this case, the idea that you have to come, right, if the culture is come with your idea because I expect that you have solved the problem, which already is a little different than what you're painting, the picture you're painting, right? So you have to have already solved the problem. So then you're coming, you've already figured it out. And now anyone who asks a question, you're just trying to defend your idea, right? You're not trying to really to amend it and fix it, right? So this idea, this kind of culture is the opposite, is antithetical to a real place of questions and answers. Right, the kind of environment we're trying to create at the Seder is one where you are coming with a sense that I actually don't have something, right? I actually don't know the answer. I'm actually trying to understand, and I have some pieces. Maybe I've right. It's we're not going to come to the Seder without any background, right? Some people do come without any background. The people I'm talking to here, right? Let's say we have experience. We have already done this for years, right? We already have experience. So it's not that we're going to like imagine that we've never seen this before, but that's actually part of his later piece. The rest of this this mimer is dealing with this idea, right? That when we come up with an answer, right? So we had a question. It was a really good question, and we really should look into it. Once I come up with an answer, now I have a sense of, okay, I figured it out. I am shalim again. And that itself often prevents me from taking in new information because I've already filled that hole. I've already solved that problem. So once I go from chisaron to shalim because I came up with an answer, now I'm shalim again. So now any other information doesn't really solve the problem anymore. You have to recognize, you have to create a new problem, or you have to recognize that you didn't really solve the problem, where there's more to understand, something like that, right? So this idea that the Seder has to go from chisaron to shlemos is something we're always really dealing with because of that idea. But the Seder is supposed to be a place where we are really coming with a true sense of curiosity to actually ask questions. And actually asking questions means I don't have an answer right now, or I don't have the full answer. I recognize that I'm missing. Can you help me fill in pieces? Can we discuss this? Can our conversation lead to me better understanding where we are? If that is the Seder, if the Seder is that process, Okay? If the Seder is that process, then who is the person who, I don't want to say it doesn't belong to the Seder, but is the person who's doing it wrong? Okay, so there. When it comes to the four, when it comes to the four sons, how to read the Eino Yodea Lishol, which is the fourth one? What is it when it says Eino Yodea? Is it Eino Yodea? We often picture him again because of our picture books as a child, right? As like a very little child, and that actually may not be the case. It may not be that right. Eino Yodea, he's not able to. Is he not able to because he's exactly. It might also be he's not a child, but he has no background at all, or something else. So putting aside the Eino Yodea Lishol for right now, just because I think most people read it, I don't know about most, it could be because of our picture books, but like most of us are picturing that as like a child. If we look at back at our questions of the Chacham and the Rasha. So we asked this question, why is the Chacham a Chacham and what makes us think the Rasha is a Rasha? Okay, so these questions of the four sons, they come from the Chumash, right? They come from the Torah. We didn't make up these questions, the Torah spelled it out for us. So let's look at the actual pasuk that they come from. So the Chacham says the following. This is in source 8. On the right side is still the Chacham. The Chumash doesn't call him a Chacham. The Chumash just asks the question. Ki yishalcha vincha machar lemor. Tomorrow, in the future, when your children ask you the question, and here's the question that we're familiar with. Maha'idos v'achukim v'amishpatim. What are all these laws that God commanded you? Okay? Now on the left side is the question of what we label as the Rasha. V'haya kiyomru aleichem b'neichem.
No question.
Oh, kiyomru aleichem b'neichem. So, if you look in a lot of translations, they say, and when your children ask you, that's how they translate it. But it's not a direct translation, because if you look at the word, how do you say to ask? So that's on the right side. A she'ela, that's a question. Sho'el is to ask. What does the word omer mean?
Just tell you.
Omer means to speak, right? Just saying it. So what's the question of the Rasha? Question of the Rasha, if you look in the pasuk, it's not actually a question. He's not asking something. He's not trying to understand. He doesn't say, I don't really get it. Why are we doing this? He says, he is telling you. He is omer his question. He's telling you his problem. What is this? That's a very different kind of question. It may be phrased as a question. It may, right, use the intonation. Why are we doing this, right? With the little up at the end that makes you think it's a question, right? But not every question is actually a question. Sometimes the example we give is when we walk into the room and my kid's room is all messy. I'm like, why is your room a mess? So like that's not the point for the child to be like, well, father, here is the reason that I left my room very messy, right? You don't actually want an answer to that question, right? You mean you're giving a message, but you're asking it in a question, right? Maybe that's not the best way to give them the message, whatever. But either way, there are times when we ask something, but we're not actually looking for the answer. I have already come to an opinion, and that's what the Rasha is coming with. So what makes us recognize that this question is different is that, how do we recognize? So that's more to discuss. But the Torah is informing us. The Torah is informing us that a chacham, when somebody comes with a real question, so you deal with that question. When somebody is saying their question, so you have to approach it differently, right? We can answer a question. We can't answer a sentence. You can't answer a sentence. You can't answer a question. But if he's not asking a question, he's just saying it. It's a statement. Right, you can't answer that. So that also may explain why the approach to the Rasha is a little different. Right, we don't seem to directly address the Rasha. The answer we give is really the answer. Right, so that's like a little bit of a discussion also. So maybe why we don't directly maybe answer it, and we give it. We explain to everybody, and maybe the Rasha. We hope the Rasha will go along with it. Right, we'll come around. So there are ways to address it. But the Torah is informing us. The Torah is saying that sometimes a question is not really a question; it's a statement. Right. And perhaps that is antithetical to the whole experience of the Seder. The Seder is one of going from Chisaron to Shlemus. It is from Gnus to Shevach, okay? So the whole Seder is going through that process, okay? So if we keep in mind, if we recognize this whole process, right, this idea that you're starting with Chisaron and you're ending with Shlemus, okay, that our world is always going through that process. So perhaps that can help us better understand the Kliyakar at the beginning. Okay, and this also is rooted in the Maharal, the Kliyakar's connection to the Maharal. But there's another Maharal that I want to see at the end of page 2, that the Maharal says, this is actually going on Parshas Ki Tisa, where Rashi mentions the idea of the Chelbana from a Gemara. So the Gemara says that if you have a Tainus, if you have a fast day that does not include the Poshe Yisrael, the sinners, if you have a fast day that doesn't include sinners, then it's not even a fast. And the Gemara learns that from the Ketores, the incense that had a lot of good smelling things, and also the Chelbana, which actually smelled bad. Okay, so you have to include it in the same thing. So Rashi says, so we learn from there, Rashi basically quotes that Gemara and says, and therefore you should include the Poshe Yisrael. So first of all, in source 9, if you look in the first paragraph, if you want to spend time afterwards, it's a time when the Maharal seems to, I want to say almost disagrees with Rashi, right? We think of the Maharal, the Gur Aryeh is a commentary on Rashi, but there are certain times when he says, I'm not sure that Rashi is presenting Chazal the way that Chazal meant to be presented. So there are a few times, right? And this is a time where the Maharal is really, you see that the Maharal is really a commentary on Medrash and Chazal, and sometimes will say, like, I'm not sure that this is the right way to say it, Rashi. Okay, so that's the first paragraph. But then he says, V'yish b'zeh k'sas mina t'miyah. It's a little strange. V'chilo adav she'yiyu kulam tzadikim. Wouldn't it be better if you have everybody davening who are tzadikim, who are righteous people? Why should you include Poshe Yisrael in your fast day? A fast day, everyone's coming together to daven. So include all the righteous people. Why should I include any of the sinners? When you're trying to have a fast, the point of a tainus is to almost afflict yourself in order to inspire mercy from God. You can't have hachna, you can't become subservient to God. You can't lower yourself in front of God if you are already there. If you are already close to God, so then you can't be machnia. You can't become close to God if you are already close to God. Ulakach. Therefore, ena tzadikim mevim harachamim. Therefore, tzadikim. Very strong statement from the Maharal. Tzadikim don't bring mercy. The davening of tzaddikim don't bring mercy. So you have to figure this out, exactly what this means. Okay, we're not going to have all the time in the world to do this. Aval harasha mevi harachamim. But a rasha can bring rachamim. Ki kasher hu rachok min Hashem yisparach. Ha'achna hu yoser. Because if you are further, then you, by definition, have more getting close to God. You have more hachna. If you are further from God, then you can now get close to God. Right? Because hachna, to lower yourself in front of God, can only come from being further away and then coming close. And that brings rachamim. And this idea of the Maharal, I think, piggybacks off of the other piece of the Maharal, is that the process of this world is one in which you always go through this process of gnus to shevach. You always have to have these contrasts. You always have to start with one and be reaching towards something else. And if you are somebody who is in a state right now already, then you are not going through this process from one to the other. So when the Kliyakar says, oh, the Bali Tshuva, that's better than a Tzadik Gamor. Oh, what do you mean? Is this Bali Tshuva really that great? He just made a mistake. And then he brought a korban. I think from the Maharal about Pesach, leading into this Maharal, we see that the whole nature of this world is to go from further away to closer. So is someone who makes a mistake and then does tshuva, is that as great as somebody who made a mistake on purpose and then overcomes their desire? Maybe it's not as great as that, but it's still better than a tzaddik, because a tzaddik is in a state of being complete. He already is there, and that's who he is. That's a tzaddik gamor. He's never made a mistake. But someone who goes from shogeg, even a mistake of shogeg, from shogeg to bringing a chatas, from making a mistake to now fixing that mistake, is also going through this process that we go through on Pesach, from chisaron, from missing, to shlemos, from gnus, to shevach, from laila, to yom. All of those are going through the same process. So when Rosh Shemach says, oh, this guy isn't such a great Baal tshuva, that's not the point. Any tshuva, by definition, is going from missing to having. from Chisaron to Shleimus. And all of that is really the story of Pesach. That's what we should think about when we're at the Seder, going through this process, not just telling the story of what the Jews experienced in Mitzrayim, but also, as Zohar says, we feel that. We should feel like we are actually the ones experiencing it. And the way that we tell the story, we should be coming from a place of feeling that we're Chisaron, right? Even though we've done this many times, right? So it's not always so easy. We have to figure out ways to do that. But we feel like we've done it, and therefore we already know the answer. Sometimes we ask the questions like Manishtana that are in the Haggadah, and we know the answer to that. And sometimes it's not a question that's in the Haggadah, but I ask it every year, and I know the right answer, right? So maybe listen to a new answer. Maybe you don't know the right answer, right? Try to find ways to go through that. And that also is through our doing tshuva. If we think of, right, it's, you don't have to be the greatest Baal tshuva in the world to be a Baal tshuva, right? Part of being a Baal tshuva is any process along this path, any step along this way from Chisaron to Shleimus is itself being a Baal tshuva, and, as the Kli Yakar says, is greater than any tzaddik gamor.